Welcome to the Monday Morning Phone Call Podcast. This is your host, Paul Joslin. Every preacher knows when they're teetering on the edge of a topic that will result in receiving a phone call on Monday morning. Instead of backing away from those topics, this podcast exists to work through these polarizing ideas and spark conversation. There are few topics more polarizing in our current context than politics. During this season, we have been rerunning episodes from season two of the Monday Morning Phone Call, airing discussions about how to navigate our polarized political landscape. We live in a country where our gospel identity is challenged by our political system. How do we navigate this tension and remain true to our identity in Christ? During this episode, Larry and I talk about how we have journeyed through the current political season in 2024 and what we've learned. We hope it's a helpful conversation on another episode of the Monday Morning Phone Call. Okay, so here we are, November 5th, 2024, and this podcast recording is important for two reasons. One, it's the day before the election, but two, it's our last podcast together on the Monday Morning Phone Call. So first, before we get into the politics of it all, how do you feel about the last recording of Monday Morning Phone Call? Monday morning phone call podcast.
Yeah, I was my only regret is that I didn't get to do a pop culture episode with Melissa Frisbee. Yeah. So that would have been so much fun to do.
Absolutely.
I'll be listening.
Yeah, there you go.
Love
it.
Love the podcast.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, we're glad you took the time to do this recording with us, and we're excited. This podcast will air after the election, so we're kind of going into this conversation blind a little bit. We don't know what will happen tomorrow, but as we kind of get ready for this conversation, what is maybe one thing that's kind of stood out to you or surprised you about the political season we found ourselves in this past year?
For me, Paul, it's been kind of the decay of truth, where politicians, on the one hand, just not only are not always straightforward with the truth or the facts or answering questions directly, they don't even seem to care about truth itself, rather care what will play well in the polling or get me elected.
Yeah.
But also, I think along with that, not just the politicians, it just seems like both sides, if you will, both camps, we don't seem to care. Yes. We hear what we want to hear and don't listen to what we don't want to hear.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. Because, if you think, we almost expect now for candidates or different political parties to kind of only say their thing, but it really does seem like people are less willing to even hear the other side, that when something comes up from the other side, it's almost like we just shut it out, we pretend it's not there, we ignore or almost automatically disregard anything they have to say as untruth right off the gate.
I don't know if you saw it this week in the Denver Post, there was an article written by Krista Kafer, who's the conservative columnist for the Denver Post, actually was in Nick Lillo, our founding pastor's, was in his youth group.
Oh, no way.
She's a good friend.
Yeah.
And she wrote a piece on the all the talk about the gangs in Aurora and really unpacked all that and said it's probably 9 or 10 people. It's, she really pulled everything back and here's the truth, and sent that to a number of friends. One of which, my brother-in-law, was a professor at a Christian college, and said, man, that is not what you hear around the nation about what's going on in Aurora, Colorado.
Yes, totally.
It's totally been blown up. And it's this idea that whatever we need to say to stir fear is what we will say.
To drive
regardless
to our
facts, factual. So I would say overall, Paul, that's been my thing. It's just the erosion of truth.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, I was going to say kind of the erosion of trust, which I think is kind of a implication of the lack of truth that we have. But I saw a statistic today that there's a poll that was done. They asked Americans to rank the goodness or evilness of people on the different political sides. And 40% of Americans agreed with the statement that people in the other political party are evil, which is just like such extreme language. But 40% was the number, like that's almost half of the people polled inherently believe that people who just vote differently than them don't just see the world differently, but are actually like evil, which even in our culture, labeling anything morally good or evil is kind of a dicey proposition, but to just be able to inherently say that about politics, I thought showed, yeah, just how deeply ingrained politics has become in our view of other people. So, yeah, it was pretty shocking.
I've thought about it because I think we'd have to agree, on the one hand, the polarization that we see today has always been in American politics, all the way back to the founding fathers.
Yep.
You read some of the disagreements they had, some of the language they used.
Yeah.
But there's something about the more recent disagreements that it has this layer, and I think this is what's so discouraging and why everyone is kind of ready for this to be done. It takes this apocalyptic level of like an evil thrown over all this. And like if we don't win,
right,
we're done.
Yes.
And it's just this heavy, heavy-handed language.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you saw it, but this past weekend there was actually a SNL skit to that effect. They had John Mulaney, the comedian, on, and he essentially was doing this game show where they were asking him to name, I think the name of it was Name That Person, and they brought out the vice presidential candidate who ran with Hillary Clinton. And then they said, you said that this was the most consequential election ever in our country, and this happened 8 years ago. Who is this person? And he was like, I don't know who that is. And we just kind of have this like drummed up idea of everything is always, again, I think it's tied to fear, but everything is the most consequential, the most dire, the most important moment. And then we think back 8 years previous, and it's like, wait, who was even running? Like, we don't remember. And so it just kind of shows that in the moment, we can make things kind of catastrophic or apocalyptic, and then after the fact we realize maybe it wasn't quite that bad. It's intense. So for our conversation today, again, we don't know what will happen on November 5th, but we thought it would be helpful to kind of just have a conversation a little bit about the series we've been preaching through. First Peter has a lot to say about politics and how Christians live faithfully in a world that's opposed to God's values. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that play out in this political season. So as we've been kind of going through this book, clarity and chaos and talking about faith in exile, are there maybe some kind of principles or key places that you think are helpful for people as they navigate this election season?
Mm-hmm. I think the first word that comes to mind is one that we've both preached pretty deeply on, is the word submission.
Yeah.
And submission to government authorities in particular.
Yep.
From chapter 2, verses 13 to 17. I can just read that real quick. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority, to the governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. And I know that when we've talked about this at times, two things really kind of stand out there. One is twice it talks about the emperor,
mm-hmm.
we believe was Nero.
Right.
And was the one that actually would put Peter to death.
Yeah.
Probably the Apostle Paul.
Yeah.
To death. So this was like not a good man.
Right.
Not a good leader.
Yeah.
And yet Peter is saying, still be submissive to that. So How do you justify? What do you think, Peter? What does that look like for?
Yeah,
Peter's encouraging the church to do there.
I think it's something that the church has really lost sight of, in that, I think the church has always been in Christianity, following Jesus, has always been for people at the margins, for people who are on the outside. And even as you look at the growth of Christianity, the people who were most attracted to it were women who had been in difficult situations, slaves, people who were poor, sick, the destitute. Christianity was the religion that put forth this idea that no matter what your station in life was, no matter what your ailment you had, in God's eyes, you were still like worthy of love and consideration. And so it starts in that space. And I think when we look at Christianity today, there's kind of this expectation that we should be at the center, not at the margins. And I think we've kind of gotten used to the idea over the last, you know, number of years that the world should kind of revolve around how we see the world. And that's not really like how the Christianity began or even how it was supposed to operate in the world. We're a community of exiles, not emperors.
We are. Yeah. One of the articles that I read to kind of prepare for this a little bit mentioned that to the degree that the church gets cozy with Rome or Babylon is the degree that we are off mission.
Yeah, lose our credibility and witness. And
the second thing that I want to hear your answer to this, Paul, the second thing that stands out to me in this text is that is God's sovereignty being subversively wrapped around government and politics.
Yeah.
In this case, talking about God has a purpose in government to silence the wrong, the ignorant talk of foolish people, punishing those who do wrong.
Yeah.
So government is actually a creation of God or an establishment of God. And so that's why we submit as well. But I'm curious what you think about, again, if it's some of the ways that the government in America specifically is going and who and what we believe God to be seems to be growing apart.
Yeah.
Your observations on that?
Yeah. I think that's the challenge and why I think people find politics so polarizing right now is I think they're looking for a solution in a space that actually can't provide the solution to what they're looking for. So I talked about this in one of my sermons, but Leslie Newbegin said of the secular culture that as we kind of pull God out, and not in a kind of like, you know, fearful way, that, but just as the world secularizes and needs God less in their worldview and can find solutions outside of him, that then we begin to place that passion and reverence that was once reserved for God in forming our worldview into politics. And so we hope that our political leaders can save us and solve the problems that we have, or we think government institutions. Now, the trick with some of that is policies matter, politicians matter, and you can solve some problems through governance, and that's why God established government. I think the challenge right now is that as we've seen kind of both parties, and we only live in a country with two parties, have drifted further and further to the extremes, then most people feel stuck in a space of one or two issues that feel really important to them, and they feel like they have to follow God in that space, but almost to follow God on these one or two issues in one area neglects a whole different subset of issues that they feel like they don't have to pay attention to or aren't important, but then they get to the place where they won't even listen to the argument about the other side. So yeah, we just feel like I feel like we're just stuck in this spot where no one can really listen to either side as things have polarized. And that felt like kind of a wandering answer. No, I don't know if you can make sense out of that.
Well, I can't. We've already gotten into this may be a little dark next.
Yeah.
The other thing, honestly, that I've been thinking about with this election, but I would say it's probably a cumulative from just the direction of politics over the last 20 or so years.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that we drift further and further from godliness, from a sense of we're becoming more secular in the way that where God is really not much in the public space more and more. And so there's a space for me to begin to ask the question, you know, is America, you know, on the downside? Have we reached the pinnacle in the past and now coming down the other side of the life cycle?
Yeah.
I guess to put the scary piece into place is, are we experiencing the judgment of God as a nation? Because the way that judgment is portrayed in Scripture, especially in Romans 1, is not that God's just going to come in, you know, and smite down
America. Yeah.
What God's judgment typically looks like for a nation or for even a person is the hands off. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
Right.
I'm going to give you what you want. And you want extreme radical individualism in every sphere of life? You've got it.
Yeah.
And that's why our moral fabric is just being pulled apart. and why truth is disappearing, why any kinds of standards are disappearing.
Yeah. I'd love for you to even kind of spell that out a little more of like where you see some of the radical individualism, because I've heard it described that, you know, the ultimate value of America is freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom of choice, freedom of conscience, freedom of, to do whatever you want. Freedom without boundaries is actually not free, and it can produce some pretty severe challenges.
That's the thing.
So how to, as you kind of see the hands off maybe happening and people kind of going full tilt into less godliness. And
I think I touched a bit on that in I think it was the sermon that I preached from the text I read earlier in First Peter 2 about what is the highest good in our culture right now is this, the idea of freedom, individual personal autonomy. But yet it's an unattainable goal in any life, because we're all enslaved to something.
Yeah.
And there's no such thing as total absolute freedom.
Yeah.
Everyone makes choices in life based on what they believe will make them happiness, comfortable or secure, whatever those are. And we become enslaved to those deep drives in the human heart, disordered loves, if we will. And so it's a myth, this idea of absolute freedom.
Yeah.
But yet people chase it aggressively.
Right.
And when they do, it's at all costs.
Yeah.
Typically relationships, lifestyle choices, health.
Yeah.
You know, authority structures.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the challenges with that is what we're seeing and more of is as people kind of step into those spaces of kind of pursuing total freedom. And this is really a problem left, right, and center, like everybody in our country.
Yes.
It's not like one particular issue is,
exactly.
But I think we can even just see this statistically, like there's data to back this up, but it's actually producing less happiness.
Yes.
It's producing less security. It's producing less self-fulfillment, which is the very promise secularism is kind of built on.
Yeah.
So I do think there's an opportunity for the church to step into that space of the gap between dreams, desires, hopes of what this kind of autonomy can provide, versus the realization that actually, like, life with God can produce the self-fulfillment and the desire, longing that we have, but within the context of boundaries. So I think that sort of, in a way, takes us to this idea of faith in exile and how we as Christians live faithfully, which I've said before, I really do think that's the question of our time for Christians, is how do we live faithfully in the particular cultural moment we find ourselves in? And you can kind of see the extremes that people go to. You know, I was actually just talking with a friend that they grew up, they weren't allowed to play Pokemon as kids because their Christian parents had heard that it was somehow designed to help people, you know, walk away from God. And so they were not allowed to play with Pokemon.
Yeah.
So sometimes there's that approach, I think, that we see from Christians, just this anything that's in the world is dangerous, scary, and meant to kind of take our faith away. And so we kind of remove ourselves, we pull ourselves out. The other place I think sometimes Christians can go is more a route of accommodation or trying to compromise certain values in order to, you know, live with people in exile. And so I think those are kind of the two extremes. There's probably a lot of examples we could give, but have you seen either of those in kind of your years of pastoring, and what does that kind of look like as you've just seen Christians trying to navigate?
That's a loaded question.
You know, it's the last one, so this is the last chance I have to offer some of this.
Yeah. I've certainly seen both those extremes, and I've certainly participated
in
those extremes. Yep. I think we all, at times, are motivated by fear, by insecurity, by wanting the best for something and thinking we have to take those strategies into our own hands, so to speak. So, yes. And I think one thing I would say about it, Paul, is it's always, that's where it's, I think, good for two things. One is to have some kind of feedback loop mm-hmm. in your life mm-hmm. Where you've given other people a hunting license to, you know, evaluate your words, your practices, your even the way, you know, you're raising children, yeah. whatever it is, with a closely connected Christian community
yeah.
who can speak some of that or at least ask questions
yeah.
about that and about that approach.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing is just a continual anchoring in Scripture. Mm-hmm. And I know that's like the big, easy answer that everyone expects us to say.
Yeah.
But in a culture where there's truth decaying
exactly. yeah.
and trust decaying,
yeah.
I think we have to stay anchored, keep acknowledging that the truth is outside of us.
Yeah.
And the more we stay anchored to that truth outside of us.
Yeah. I think that's such a key point, because in the culture that's, you know, kind of full tilt chasing after autonomy or self-definition, acknowledging that I think it was the book You Are Not Your Own where he talks about the, you know, the it comes from the Heidelberg Catechism where it says you know, our greatest joy in life and death is that we are not our own, but we're our Christ's. And and that sounds like an odd phrase to say, that, you know, we are not our own is our great source of joy. But really, it's the revelation that we don't have to self-define. We don't have to find happiness ourselves. We don't have to, because the weight of all of that can actually be fairly crushing. And so I think, yeah, recognizing that created in God's image, and then that truth is actually outside of ourselves and not something that we can self-define is really important and really helpful.
Yeah. Well, Paul, we've been pretty heavy here.
Yeah.
Judgment, and truth decay, and trust decay.
I know, we're like 10 minutes in.
We need some joy here. Yeah. So I'm curious, you know, whatever happens tomorrow,
yeah.
half of the country is going to be,
yeah.
if the polls are right, half are going to be
right.
disappointed, half yeah. are going to be satisfied.
Yeah. But,
as a pastor, what would you say to both sides?
Yeah, you know, Steph and I were talking about, I think we're going to watch the election together, and we might be a little bit sick, because we were like, we should get some, like, wings and jalapeno, like, you know, make a Super Bowl out of it, and just try to, I don't know if it's like the violins playing as the Titanic went down or what, but we're going to try to have fun with it. But then I think it's less about Tuesday night for me and more about Wednesday morning, and what does Wednesday morning look like. And, you know, I did vote this year. I think actually while we're recording this, my wife is voting right now. And but regardless of whether or not who we voted for is in office, I think our posture remains the same. And particularly this election, I think, you know, there are different things that either party might stand for that I could get on board with, and certainly things on both parties that I can't at all. And so I think there's a responsibility when you don't identify with either party of the day after. It's the exact same thing. You know, you made your choice, you cast your ballot, you leave the results up to God, but then the response after is still, I think, one of critique and prophetic voice mm-hmm. that the church has to call out, you know, to encourage when we see things happening that we think do align with Scripture, and then to also challenge when we see things that don't. And so you know, sometimes there's so much buildup to the day of the vote, and then people just walk away, and you know, they'll come back in 4 years
right.
or 3 years when everybody starts fighting about it again. But I think for the Christian, there's a really important acknowledgement that the day after is when the work begins, and
yes.
when people need to engage even more and hold accountable the people they voted into office, and you know, not just trust these people to do whatever they have power and authority to do. So that's a little bit of what we've talked about is Wednesday morning. What's our, you know, our first move? Probably just getting the kids ready and getting them to school. But then, that's when the challenge and the prophetic voice, I think, comes into effect. So.
That's a great phrase you had there. The work begins.
Yeah.
September 6th.
Yeah. But how about for you as you kind of engage?
Yeah, I would say similar. Live as an exile.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, that's at least three things. One is prayer.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Paul, Peter, very clear.
Yeah.
No matter who wins, and pray. I mean, history belongs to the intercessors,
yeah,
as Walter Wink said.
Yeah.
There's a sense in which some of that's just too much for us. How, like, what does God do with our prayers? All how all that works, how prayer shapes reality.
Yeah.
That's a mystery.
Yeah.
But it's a mystery that we should live by.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, do you mind if I jump in? Because I was thinking about that, you know, this idea of faith in exile and how we live. And the kind of book in the Bible that gives us the clearest picture of what it means to live out faith in exile is Daniel. And a big part of Daniel is prayer. And in fact, one of the reasons he was in trouble was because of the consistency and routine of his prayer. People knew, you know, he prayed three times a day, and so they knew where to find him because he was that prayerful. And I've wondered if we have a similar posture, what that might look like. Prayer is a great
example. Great example.
Yep.
I would say second is perspective, and we've talked about this already, I think, but keeping politics, so to speak, in its place.
Yes.
It's a tension in a bit because on the one hand, I think everything's political. Yep. The kingdom of God is the most political thing Jesus and the New Testament writers could have said, that there's a new kingdom, a different kingdom, a coming kingdom. And that it absorbs everything, you know, marriage, sexuality, how to parent. All that is how to run a government, all that's wrapped into that idea of kingdom. So in one sense, it's everything. But on the other sense, it's this idea of politics, I think, has to be kept in a place within the kingdom and what it can and cannot do.
Right, yeah. Almost compartmentalized.
So prayer
and perspective.
I would say the third thing is, and again, both Peter and Paul mentioned this about giving honor. And the idea of honor, going even back to the fourth commandment about honoring your parents.
Yeah.
The idea of the Hebrew word there was to make room for them.
Yeah.
You always make room for your parents in your busy lives. That's how you honor them. Not even so much a feelings-driven word as much as an obedience thing. And I think the same's true in a sense for politics, for the emperor in particular, for government leaders. You make room for them in your life. Often that's through prayer, but I think it's also about being a good citizen.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, but voting, taking responsibility. I think some believers pursuing vocational call to government. And so it's much about citizenship.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah, along those lines. And I think it maybe ties in with both the last two points you made around perspective and stuff, but I saw something where it was an image of the two candidates this year, Harris and Trump, but it was an image of each of them as children. And it just kind of put it into perspective a little bit that, when we're talking about all these ideas and these policies, and I think there's dangerous ideologies in our country, no doubt, but at the end of the day, we're still dealing with people who are created in God's image, and that has to be the starting place of our perspective. Now, it doesn't mean we endorse evil or we allow people to be unaccountable to their actions, but I think the place Christians start from is very different and something that's missing from our country right now in a lot of the discourse, where we just see people who disagree with us as enemies rather than people to be loved. So, as you kind of think about this idea of faith in exiles, you know, the election happening, and as we're kind of maybe wrapping up the conversation here, is there a particular place that you feel like, you know, what I feel like at times is certain people will say, you know, the church is supposed to vote left or vote right. Other people will say that the church is supposed to be more center and not... And I've always thought the church is actually supposed to kind of break those paradigms and exist outside of, but we still exist within a left-right two-party system. And I think there are some dangerous ideas. And so how would you encourage a Christian, to engage in a season where it does feel like, you know, we joked about not every election is the most dire, but it does feel like there's a lot at stake at the same time. And so how would you encourage a Christian to engage, to reflect, to think, I don't know. I think that's the place most people feel stuck. So help us get unstuck.
The one thought that comes to my mind, Paul, is I think often we tend to get stuck in those places when we think that the election is really about one or two issues. Mm. And then in that way, if your candidate loses, you lose everything.
Yeah.
Everything. So could it be helpful if we keep in mind and keep like roping ourselves up to a bigger perspective that in every election, at least here in America, there's righteousness on both sides. Mm. There's certain, let's say, blue issues that God's very concerned about. Yeah. There's certain red issues that God's very concerned about. Does it have to be an all or nothing
proposition
yeah. in our voting? I know I came across an old, I think this was in the New York Times, but it was Timothy Keller, Keller,
yep.
who pastored in Manhattan for many years. And he quotes a British ethicist named James Mumford. And Mumford has said that one of the big problems with American politics is they become package deals where increasingly political parties insist that you cannot work on one issue with them if you don't embrace all of their approved positions. Mm-hmm. This emphasis on package deals puts pressure on Christians in politics. For example, following both the Bible and the early church, Christians should be committed to racial justice and the poor, but also to understanding that sex is only for marriage and for nurturing family. One of those views seems liberal. The other looks oppressively conservative. The historical Christian positions on social issues do not fit into contemporary political alignments. So Christians are pushed towards two main options. One is to withdraw and try to be apolitical. The second is to assimilate and fully adopt one party's whole package in order to have your place at the table. Neither of those options is valid.
Yeah.
In the Good Samaritan parable told in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus points us to a man risking his life to give material help to someone of a different race and religion. Jesus forbids us to withhold help from our neighbors, and this will inevitably require that we participate in political processes with people with whom we disagree.
Mm.
I just thought that was a great perspective from Keller about, and it gets to, I think, what the Titus perspective is too, where in Titus chapter 3, the same thing, be subject to the authorities, be obedient, but also Titus adds, and this is like 8 or 9 times in the letter, do good.
Yeah, yes.
Do good to shape your culture, do good to your neighbors.
Yes.
Do good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's even a phrase that we've seen come up throughout First Peter. You know, it talks about being exiles, sojourners, foreigners, but allow your good deeds, doing good to be what people remember about you. And maybe that's a good place for us to end it on, is the work begins the day after with doing good and engaging with the faith. Bringing about good in our culture. So
it's good.
Yeah. Larry, thanks for the conversation.
You bet.
Thanks for being willing to.
It'll be an interesting day.
Yeah.
Interesting a few weeks ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well, thanks, Larry.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Monday Morning Phone Call podcast. We hope that this show has sparked conversation and that you would even share this episode with a friend. This podcast is hosted by me, Paul Joslin, and today's show was edited and mixed by Paul Romig-Levitt. Produced by Emily Kloss, and the graphic was designed by Lane Gerke. Special thanks to Larry for joining us and giving the pastoral perspective on the political journey that we're navigating. Thanks for tuning in.